This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Feels like I get an opportunity to visit and talk at Hartford Street, you know, once or sometimes twice a year. And it feels a great deal like a home of mine, a neighborhood that I know, some familiar faces, and maybe it's just that I'm getting older, but I find a lot of comfort in that kind of thing. Looking at the bookshelves and seeing a bunch of stuff by Philip or about him or, you know, some work by people that I've known over the years, all of this is a comfort. So the topic that I have been working on lately is in the Book of Serenity, which is a book that you may have encountered. It's pretty thick. It has Chinese characters on the front, and it's actually a Zen Center production, way back when Richard Baker commissioned Cleary. What's his first name?
Thomas
Cleary, already pretty well known translator, to work on the Book of Serenity. And I imagine he spent a number of years on it, and in the foreword by Reb, he mentions some of that process. And in the Buddhist world, there's a lot of references, there's a lot of territory, and I usually have a great deal of trouble retaining much of it. But just a little orientation, the Book of Serenity is considered to be sort of one of the great classics in the Soto tradition, and then also in Japanese referred to as the Shoyoroku. And then there's the Blue Cliff Record, which is another koan collection, and that is for whatever reason favored or associated with the Rinzai folks. And so I'll read the koan that I have in mind, which is called Yangshan's Mind and Environment. Yangshan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yangshan said, "What do you think of that place?" The monk said, I think of it always." Yangshan then said, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, landmass, buildings, towers, halls and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thought and think of the thinking mind. Are there many things there?" The monk said, "When I get there, I don't see anything at all, or I don't see any existence." Yangshan said, "That is right for the stage of faith, not yet for the stage of person." The monk then said, "Don't you have any other particular way of guidance?" Yangshan said, "To say I have anything particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you only get one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe. After this, see on your own." In our particular lineage, these are people who feature or are featured in the line which eventually ends up with the Tiantong Monastery. And Tiantong is where Dogen went to practice in China. And so these things used to be just names for me, and in some large measure they still are, but for whatever reason they're becoming more interesting. In China in those days, prior to Dogen's era, the style of practice, which was pretty developed, monastic, pretty, you know, tough, hard practice, this was considered the cow dung line, which is an easy name to remember. And so when Dogen gets there and has his study and then returns to Japan, it then sort of translates into what we refer to as the Soto School. Another thing that Buddhism is very big on is lists, and this lineage in China has a number of arrays of, you know, orientation, description, whatever, that are things that I've maybe heard and forgotten probably a number of times. One of them is referred to as the five ranks. And the five ranks in this early era were referred to as the relative within the absolute, which supposedly is detachment and interruption of habits, the absolute within the relative, merging with the environment, coming from within the absolute, which is supposedly turning to development, observation, and action, arrival in the relative, mastery of action in the world, and arrival in both relative and absolute, harmony, integration, and transcendence. These are just descriptions. And one of the things that I'm noticing is a lot of the descriptions that I run into in practice are things that I encounter. They may have some impression. I may remember them for a day or a week, but for the most part, they just come and go. After the fact, things that I was pretty hazy on or pretty maybe even uninterested in come into view, sort of in the rearview mirror. You see in retrospect, oh, that was a real challenge, that was a real difficulty, or that was a real mystery to me, and now it doesn't feel like such a big deal. I don't know if you, many of you have been to the ashes site at Tassajara, Big Suzuki Roshi Memorial, but there are a number of memorial pillars, and on those pillars there's a carved series of shapes, and that corresponds to the five ranks. There are other categorizations such as the three roads, the three falls, and the three leaks. The leaks, I thought, would be worth mentioning. The leak of views, that's like you run into somebody and they have these convictions about the way the world is or the way they should be, and that's it for them. That is a fixed position, and they're going to find ways of believing that despite anything you might think or do. So the leak of views, the leak of feelings, and the leak of words. The ox-herding pictures are another system of describing practice or describing the unfolding. And another list would be referred to as like the four types. All of these classifications were subject to the usual periodic ridicule or review. And they're probably, as I said, more useful in retrospect than in the first encounter, as are often koans. So my approach to this description of this koan, the Cleary translation, is just to go through it and give you my impressions. And I think that koan study at least for the people that I know, is kind of undergoing a kind of a new approach or a new kind of reevaluation. I've never worked with a teacher on koans, and I've never been particularly attracted to it. But and I had come at it with a kind of a built-in bias against the Rinzai approach. You know, that always seemed pretty theatrical, pretty dramatic in ways that didn't intrigue me much. A good friend of mine who studies with a koan in a Rinzai tradition asked his teacher, he meets with every year up in around Seattle on Whidbey Island, and this is a very well-regarded, you know, teacher in the Rinzai lineage, Japanese guy who really, really does some very severe and challenging practice with people, long, hard sesshins. And so this friend asked this teacher for a koan, and the teacher's response was, "Now you don't need a koan. Just burn yourself up with shikantaza." So that was his recommendation. So for me, the folks, you know, like Suzuki, who is an extraordinary exemplar of the Soto approach, just always made much more sense, was more resonant and relevant to things that I was interested in. Also, I would say that Suzuki as a practitioner, although he was extremely well developed in terms of his understanding of all the literature and the sutras and so forth, was fundamentally not, his presentation was not scholarly necessarily. It was really much more, in my own mind, somewhat more of a poet. He understood and was able to develop and describe things in English that to me have held up extraordinarily well. But in the koan, in the Soto way and Soto tradition, we're not ignoring the koan world anymore. And what I've been finding, it's not just koans. You know, all the works of Dogen and Huineng and Nagarjuna and the other great ones in our tradition are koan literature. They really are. They have the same kind of dynamic, the same kind of, in some sense, impenetrability or coming at you from an unexpected direction. And what I have been noticing is that people are interested, and more specifically, what I've been discovering is when I try to do this on my own, when I read koans on my own, koan collections or whatever, for the most part, they put me to sleep. However, when I read them with others, when we sit around and read or go through a sutra or a koan and talk about it in terms of what might be going on there, it's a very different thing. So I have had an opportunity to sit with a bunch of younger practitioners, and I say younger, they may have been practicing for 5 or 10 years, but at any rate, they're a bit younger than I. And they're somewhat fearless with regard to koans. They just sort of jump in and give their impressions. And some of them have a great sort of a feel for the kind of myriad ways in which you can experience and consider koans. And others, their response seemed kind of predictable or rote. But that doesn't detract from the fact that almost everyone who really puts themselves into the koan and tries to express something beyond the obvious, there's a form of self-expression there that I think is pretty interesting. So koans in general, you know, are worthwhile considering from your obvious own point of view. What resonates, what is baffling, what is irritating. Koans are basically inside stories. You kind of are dropped in the middle of a conversation. These people may have known each other for 30 years. And they have a way of relating to each other, which, at least according to the story, is pretty uninhibited. So although to us the language may seem pretty remote or overblown or who knows what, it does represent something that you can get, you can develop a taste for or an affinity for. And sometimes, you know, getting a feel for a koan is like getting the joke. And other times it may be more interesting to consider your relationship to it in somewhat the same way you might relate to Zen services. And what's interesting about that is maybe that it's not so much the text or the topic or the chant that's really an issue at that moment. It is your relationship to it or your response to it. So, for example, everybody bows at the same time. And you certainly have noticed that some people, not so interested, not so enthusiastic. Like, they're wondering, why are we doing this? Well, that's a perfectly reasonable question. And the interesting thing is, for them, why is it a question? You know, we do these things quite routinely, but they are revealing in terms of our own relationship to practice. You know, some people want to be shown the logic of everything. Some people feel that their point of view is maybe I would say almost everybody thinks their point of view is kind of special. And so how willing are you to experiment with another point of view? One of the things that I have described monastic practice as is experimenting with life outside of the stream of your own preference. These things are said very clearly and quite obviously in many ways, but we all need to go through that process to see and discover for ourselves what the value of that is. Because it's not obvious. Jerome Peterson is one of the early sages in the Zen Center world, many people were inclined to kind of be dismissive of, because he was such an unlikely looking person, and he was not socialized in the way that many people are. But I would say that his Shuso ceremony was one of the great highlights of his era. Jerome said at one point, the trouble with Buddhism is that it's invisible. And that's, for me, pretty interesting, because I think it's quite true. And it's not just invisible to others, people looking in and seeing, you know, these serious people going through these motions. It's invisible to the people doing it. You don't really know what you're in the midst of. You don't really know what your struggle is. You just know it's a struggle. You know it's uncomfortable, or you know it's quite a sense of relief, perhaps, to get away from it. You know that. But you don't really know what you're up against. You're kind of going through various gates. Suzuki said, you know, if it doesn't feel like it's forcing something on you, it isn't Buddhism. Which I think is another pretty telling comment.
Could you say that again?
Beg your pardon?
Could you repeat the last two sentences?
Suzuki is known for saying, if it doesn't feel like it's forcing something on you, it isn't Buddhism. Another way of describing it is, if you're not really feeling your resistance, you're not really practicing. This may sound grim, but it's just one side of, you know, it's one side of the coin. You know, I would say, Sashin, for example, is a good example of this in my own mind. You know, we sit hard, physically demanding, emotionally taxing, kind of overwhelming. It's sort of a controlled nervous breakdown or something, as often as not. We have this experience. You know, we do this, we say, I'm going to do this, this is what I want to do. Maybe we wonder if we really do want to do it, but at any rate, we're doing it. And at the end of 5 days or 6 days or 7 days, it's not unusual to feel quite light and grateful. Now, that's not an experience you could explain to somebody who hasn't done that. Makes no sense. So, to return to the koan, the monk, you know, when he responds, he expresses his situation very clearly. He asks, do you think of home? I think of it always. And then the teacher asks, when you reverse your thought, what do you see? And again, I think the monk responds very well. I don't see anything. Very straightforward. Now, there's a whole lot of people that sit, and all they see is their struggle. That's what they see. It might be comfortable, it might be uncomfortable. But most of us, most of the time, experience our meditation as something that needs to be improved. We need to sit up straighter, we need to calm down, we need to breathe, and all that. And we're trying to remember that. That's the struggle that goes on and on. But this particular monk has got to the point where he kind of appreciates what we might glibly describe as emptiness. He is experiencing something. I don't see anything. His don't see anything includes all of that stuff. It includes all of his struggle. But he realizes that there is some value there. So it actually, this koan brings us, I think, to a very common place in practice, which is, why are we so challenged by sitting? And the question that I might pose is, what were we expecting? So in addition to sitting, you know, the challenges of and demands of community practice are pretty substantial. So in the process of sitting and in the demands of practice, it's pretty easy for us to quite frequently imagine or notice that we can imagine something else. We can imagine being more comfortable. We can imagine being more relaxed. We can imagine being more confident, whatever. And because we notice this in our sitting, we may also begin to notice that we also lead our lives in this same way. We're in a situation. People ask, how's it going? And, you know, you can say, you could be honest to some degree, well, you know, there's this and there's that. Which is to say, we can always imagine a better situation. And of course, the challenge of Buddhism is to be satisfied with what's going on the moment. And that's always there, and I think there is a convergence that can occur. We can experience that convergence in sitting, and we can experience that convergence in life, where we narrow the gap between our ideal and our experience. Or we see the limitations of our ideal. When I first came to Zen Center, I just wandered in. It was within the first week or so, I ran into a very tough senior monk, senior student, And he asked, "What is your situation?" And I said something to the effect of, "I'm not so sure." But another take on that particular koan is what inspired that question in him, or what inspired my response in me. Actually, I was doing just fine. You know, it might have taken me a decade or two to reach that conclusion. You can say it's a conclusion, or sort of a layer or two of acceptance. I had felt that way to some degree in my regular life, but I had not had that sensation or experience in what I would describe as my practice life. And one way I understand that is your practice life is significantly challenging. You're not just rolling along in the line of least resistance. You're actually taking on additional weight, additional demands, whether it's just showing up and sitting on some basis or whatever. But you know, again, I think it's very interesting, sort of like what Jerome referred to. You can look at a practice place and it really doesn't look like much is happening. You know, people are going through these paces and they're pretty serious, and sometimes they seem to be enjoying themselves, and sometimes it seems clearly, you know, they're just struggling. But I think there's many good things about that, and I think that when people are struggling, one, it means they're actually attempting to do something. And that's worthwhile. And they're reflecting the fact that they see many contradictions between the world as it is and the world that might be, and they are interested in making some difference on that front. Anyway, the comment that the teacher says to this monk, that's right for the stage of faith, but not for the stage of person. You know, for me, the stage of faith is a very interesting term. We have various kinds of expressions and various kinds of understanding, various kinds of assumptions about this. You could describe someone as one of the faithful. You know, that might be a little bit ironic, that might be a little bit glib, but for me, that's pretty interesting. My ordination name from Norman is Lion of Faithfulness. That was a complete surprise to me. I had no idea where he got that. But I wasn't used to thinking of myself in those terms. And interestingly enough, I had lost track of the fact that lineage matters. What I mean by that is I studied with Richard Baker because he was Suzuki's successor. I'm studying with Norman because he embodies things I respect. So I survived practicing with Richard, but I learned, and I learned a lot, but I'm inspired by people like Mel and Norman. So in some ways we're all stuck by, or stuck on, or stuck to various earlier versions of ourselves. I originally thought of myself more as kind of an outsider, somewhat of a contrarian. But that's not necessarily the way I am or necessarily the way people experience me. So many people associate faith with what I would describe as false confidence. You know, they see faith as, well, it's just an opinion, just a belief, What's a belief? It's just something you happen to believe. But Buddhism is a lot more sophisticated than this. And Nagarjuna, one of the great sages in our lineage, demonstrated that any intellectual position you can imagine or you can take can be refuted. Nothing you can think that if you really are rigorous about it cannot be examined and refuted. So that's pretty interesting. It also means that that practicing the Buddha way is not a matter of intellect, which is kind of a hard one for us to swallow, or understanding. So you can be very smart, you can understand a lot, and somehow that misses something very significant. And in the description of Buddhism, they tell you this stuff again and again. So one of the phrases that I've been sort of running into and sort of maybe stumbling on a bit lately is the Buddha way is far beyond fullness and lack. That really covers everything. But it's not something that we easily come to or take on. I don't know where I heard it, but recently I ran into this expression, doubt is necessary, but conviction is an absurdity. So all of this is interesting enough, at least I find it interesting, and I think you're probably all aware that everyone on the planet is a believer. You know, it may be God or country, it might be science or the marketplace, liberty or independence, who knows. But when pressed, everyone out there, here, has some very, very firm ideas on what's really going on, what's at issue. Which is why I found it so completely revolutionary when I ran across the phrase from Suzuki, I don't really believe in anything. That is very high order, and I think it offers a great deal of insight into the scale and the direction of practice. He said it other ways, and my other favorite is, the blue sky is my home. So, you know, it was said of Suzuki that he had great faith in himself, but and his ability to help people. Or more precisely, he had faith in us, you know, to recognize in ourselves and in him the importance of what he was holding up and what he exemplified. Mrs. Suzuki, his wife, said, he doesn't really want anything. And yet, many of his students, quite a few of them, redirected their lives and reorganized themselves in light of his example and his practice. He also made clear that he didn't invent this stuff, which is to say the Soto way, the tradition of practice and monastic discipline that he exemplified came from these eras, the era of Yangshan and these others. So thinking about faith, I think it's necessary to examine what it is and what we're actually talking about when we use the term. One of the people that I associate very strongly with faith is Isan Dorsey. And I think because he was so familiar with loss and exile, he was more comfortable being himself than most of us. And also because he understood theater, he didn't let his feelings and doubts complicate his life that much. His primary mode was taking care of people, keeping things simple, and a light touch. And intimacy with him was a bit elusive. But his acceptance of everyone was huge. So I would say his most striking feature was his ability to meet and accept people without reservation, without judgment. So for me, faith is really more a sense of possibility, more in the realm of intuition than opinion. So when Yangshan said to the monk, "You're at the stage of faith," it's actually a big deal. He's definitely on the path and, from some points of view, very well advanced. And he leaves him with a mystery. His mystery is the robe and the bowl, or the robe and his seat in the Zendo. So a monk's life is filled, you know, to overflowing with demands and constraints. And as we say in our chant, this way of life is the best in the world. And as for the mystery, Suzuki, I think, said it very well when he said, "I'm not trying to sell you anything. I just want you to be my customer." But like the monk in the story, we have yet to absorb the Heart Sutra. No form, no sensation, no perception, and so on. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Yangshan implies that the monk, like we, have yet to merge difference and unity. It's just an expression, as far as I'm concerned. For the Buddha way is far beyond all inverted views. In sitting, there's a temptation to stay with what is smooth and comfortable. And yet, our restless and conflicted zazen may well be as relevant and useful as those brief periods of what I call coursing in the unconditioned. So in sitting, we need to see our urge to escape or to excel, to submerge or to study from a distance. All these strategies are considered, adopted, reviewed, and outgrown until we begin to experience the mind without hindrance, without dwelling anywhere. The mind that sees all the places that we hold and hide and hesitate. Therefore, we proclaim the mind that has always been with us, the mind of warmth and affection, of simplicity and directness. The elusive one you are seeking is yourself, and not just any self, the one with a poem in her heart. So that's my story. Hope it wasn't too long. I wasn't keeping track of time. I'd be happy to hear any comments or controversies or whatever you like. David?
Early on in your talk, you were speaking about the Rinzai approach, and I just remembered, before I even came to Buddhism, sort of spirituality was in the air in the late 60s and early 70s, and I read D.T. Suzuki, and oh, what a mistake that was. That led me down a track that I had the hardest time getting off of. About, this is what Buddhism is about.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he
no
was.
No offense to G.C. Suzuki.
Right. No, I think he was very, very, very well regarded as a scholar and as a, you know, as an exemplar of the tradition in introducing people to, you know, Buddhism. I do like the way Suzuki, our Suzuki, related to him by saying, you know, he's the big Suzuki, I'm the little Suzuki. As you may know, in the Buddhist world, they consider Rinzai is for soldiers, for warriors, and Soto is for farmers. And I've always liked that, and I also have become quite convinced that, you know, our approach is far more sophisticated. We do not have I feel like the idea of educating each other or being with each other is far more resonant and relevant than anything you can conjure up on your own. So the idea of sitting and then having an experience and that experience somehow being big, which is kind of part of the Rinzai culture. I don't know. That's all. I admit to being a little smug on this point, but still, I don't know.
Smug in your not knowing this.
Yeah. Anyway.
So you were talking about the Book of Serenity. So you are working with koans in a way, but
yeah.
You'd say different than Rinzai.
Well, I'm different in the style that I'm not going to, you know, line up and then charge the, you know, at the bell and try to get in first in line to get to talk to the teacher for 15 seconds about my latest thought.
Okay.
That style is what has been presented, whether that's true or not. Probably a lot of it is also not quite so crazy dramatic. But yeah, in Norman's style of teaching, because he's somewhat of a scholar and very much interested in this stuff, we're doing a series of four koans in the course of this month, and I presented this one recently, which is how I got to be prepared for this. But I think, it's something that I used to be dismissive of, and now I feel is a very fruitful realm, but particularly for group conversation. You know, the older Zen Center style of class that I remember, which I really had very little feeling of connection or appreciation at the time, might have been just my resistance, who knows, but it really felt like, you know, there was the assumption that there would be somebody who had studied a fair amount and would be talking about it and we would be absorbing. And now there definitely feels to me a much more circular sense of people reading and studying together as being really the very worthwhile way of connecting, because quite frankly, I'm never gonna be a scholar. I can't stay awake for that kind of effort. But I feel very much like I might have something to offer. I definitely have something to learn in the context of other people. Just thinking about this stuff out loud.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for inspiring and invoking. What do you think of the evolution of Buddhist language in the Western world, especially in the English-speaking world, in the last few decades? You know, it struck me that when you said that you did koan study, and I used to think, like, how one could study koan if you don't know what it's written in what language. But then you also mentioned that it's also a sort of intellectual exercise to have self-expression or whatnot. And so having said that, you know, the language development, you know, it's progressing in the Dharma's study in such a different culture and language for hundreds of thousands of years.
Right.
So has it changed dramatically since you started and now?
I'm inclined to think that we have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that various folks have different fascinations with this. You know, for example, I had an opportunity this year, in the last two or three months, to sit a Zen Center Sesshin, which I hadn't done in 20-some years. The Genzawei was Shohaku Okumura, who is a scholar. He's a demon scholar. I mean, he is relentlessly interested in the language of Dogen. And I, again, struggled with it. You know, I respond very, very vividly to a lot of what Suzuki says, and I don't grow tired of hearing it. Shohaku is different, even though I like him a lot personally, and his presentation personally is extraordinarily good. There's that side of it, which is to say many people are interested, and he's presenting a very fresh and very highly considered version of a Japanese experience of the Dogen world, and giving us an appreciation of some of the nuances of the language. That's very interesting, and it can be. I'm not particularly a scholar, so for me it isn't quite as resonant, and some people get very, what I think of as hung up, but it may be more polite to say, interested in the translation differences. So you can look at two or three versions of these things and see, you know, this is this and this is that. But I feel like actually language, to be really resonant, comes from you. We all take it in and understand it in our own ways, and it's kind of amazing that we understand each other as well as we do. Really, I mean, there's a lot of our whole imprint on our experience causing our language to be filtered and homogenized and tuned up in our own unique ways. So, you know, those kinds of what I would call distortions or confusions are much more prevalent than the gaps that may or may not have been created by the 2,000-year-old story. We respond to the story, but what makes it alive is what comes from us. And that's really, they say that relentlessly in Buddhism. You know, a koan has no meaning in a way unless you make it your own. What is that? Well, you can go talk to somebody, you know, and see if he agrees with you or think that you're onto something, or maybe you don't need that kind of confirmation. I think there is a tendency for people to think that there is some, you know, right answer. There is a condition of appreciation that you may connect with another person. That's very good. I don't know if I'm responding to your question, but that's what occurs to me.
So we practicing Zen, and American Zen in particular, both same time.
Yeah, I think we're doing great. You know, for example, Norman toured a little bit in Korea, where the style of Zen practice is quite archaic in some ways. It's very highly scripted and formalized in some ways that they themselves are not particularly comfortable with. They're very interested in what Americans are up to. We see a lot of people who are, you know, willing to devote themselves to this strange exercise and investigation. In Japan, certainly, you know, it's more like a career path in many, many ways. And then there are some really great, relentlessly devoted teachers, and all that is great. But, you know, a lot of people experience Japanese Buddhism as, you know, this wonderful cultural relic. And I'm not trying to demean it, because I appreciated it more second time around than I did before. I do think that there's a lot of vitality in it, regardless.
Amy, one more question.
Sure.
I appreciate what you said about the challenges of practice. And I don't know if you said, did Suzuki Roshi say, if it isn't forcing a change on you? I don't remember the exact quote. And I can relate to that, but at the same time, I know that in Dogen's Zazen instruction, he says that Zazen is the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, which I can also relate to. I'm just curious if you have anything to say about that.
Well, it feels kind of schizophrenic, because it is. You know, you have that experience, I'm sure. You know, sitting, it covers a wide range possibility. And I think we have a tendency to say, oh, this is it, and this is not so it. Well, taking it all in and being somehow or other okay with all of it is part of what a maturing practice involves, I think.
I can relate to both.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're both there.
I think we do become comfortable and appreciative of the contradictions. You know, we contain multitudes, to quote the man. Anyway, we've been running fairly long, so.